Ora, bem-vindos a mais uma edição do Sumo de Uva. Hoje temos uma edição um bocadinho especial. Estamos a gravar um episódio ao vivo aqui no Zenith Bar Galeria, em Lisboa. Ainda não lançámos, no momento em que estamos a gravar isto, ainda não lançámos nenhum dos podcasts. Portanto, vai aqui haver um momento de estranheza para as pessoas do nosso público, enquanto eu vou fazer uma espécie de recap daquilo que estivemos a falar nos últimos episódios. Mas basicamente, se nos têm seguido, o Sumo de Uva é uma espécie de escola de vinhos, em que temos tentado estar a aprender um bocadinho mais sobre o que é esta coisa estranha e mítica que é o vinho. No primeiro episódio abordámos o que é o vinho, no segundo episódio falámos um bocadinho de como escolher um vinho e de como comprar vinho, no terceiro episódio tentámos perceber um bocadinho como fazer uma análise organoléptica ou como provar um vinho, por assim dizer. No quarto episódio estivemos a tentar ver uma coisa muito interessante, que é o efeito da temperatura na produção de vinhos com a mesma casta em diferentes regiões, e no último episódio estivemos a fazer um bocadinho uma introdução a essa região fantástica, extremamente diversa, que é a região do vinho verde. E hoje temos uma coisa um bocadinho diferente, daí também estarmos a gravar um episódio ao vivo aqui no Zenith Bar Galeria, a quem desde já aproveito para agradecer o convite e o facto de nos terem disponibilizado a sala para estarmos aqui. Vamos ter um bocadinho uma sessão, que é uma espécie de entrevista e também uma prova de vinhos com uma sommelier. E o que é isto de sommelier? Um sommelier, também conhecido como escansão na gíria portuguesa, é uma pessoa que escolhe vinhos para uma lista, para uma carta de vinhos num restaurante, e ajuda as pessoas a escolherem vinhos num restaurante. E a sommelier que aqui temos é uma pessoa que eu acho que faz um trabalho absolutamente entusiasmante e um trabalho muito interessante, que é a Camille Picherie. E a Camille estudou gestão em França e viveu e trabalhou já um bocadinho por todo o mundo. Trabalhou na Fricote, que é uma revista muito interessante de comida em francês, que, com fotografia espetacular, e que é um projeto muito interessante e dinâmico sobre o mundo da comida. Depois começou por trabalhar no Le Coq et Boc, uma extensão de um restaurante com uma estrela Michelin, que é o La Rolonge, e depois trabalhou no Le Crambon com o Edward Delling Williams em Paris, e finalmente veio para Lisboa um bocadinho fascinada pelos vinhos portugueses, que é algo que ela nos vai contar um bocadinho daqui a bocadinho. Trabalhou no Sem Maneiras e agora está no Prado, que é um restaurante farm to table que está a revolucionar aquilo que nós sabemos sobre a cozinha portuguesa. No Prado, a carta de vinhos é maioritariamente natural e biodinâmica, novamente termos que vamos tentar decifrar um bocadinho com a ajuda da Camille. E esta edição do podcast, já agora, a entrevista vai acontecer maioritariamente em inglês, porque para também facilitar a conversa e para fazer a conversa fluir um bocadinho mais. E desde já, Camille, thank you so much for being here at Sumo de Uva. It's a great pleasure for us to have you here. And I'm just going to jump right in and just ask you a bit of a general question. How did you get started, you know, working with food and wine, and what draws you to these things?
Well, I was passionate since really young. I realized I wanted to work with food really the day I started at Fricote. Actually, the first day that I opened one Fricote before even working for them. And that was the culture, that was the emotion that actually talked to me a lot. And this magazine in particular was pretty amazing because it was a really general, like really urban point of view on what is food. And I figured, yeah, that's okay, I want to talk, to smell, I want to touch, I want to pick. That's what I want to do. Working at the magazine was really amazing, and then I figured I needed more and to work really on the field to understand like what it was to work in a restaurant, because I mean the project was here, like that was the restaurant.
And what is it like? Did you start, when you went to the restaurant, did you start immediately working with wines, or was that something that came up later?
I actually, at the Coquet Buck, as you were saying, I was working with a friend, and I figured I wanted to work in the kitchen first. And I soon realized that what was actually exciting during service was actually to make the food even more beautiful with the drinks. So wine went, amazing. Like, it came from here, really, really, really fast.
And from there, you worked at Le Grand Blanc, which is also, I'm sorry if I'm not pronouncing that
perfect.
Correctly.
Le Grand Blanc.
Thank you.
That is it.
Which is also a sort of an institution in Paris. And then you decided to come to Portugal. How did that happen?
Well, Paris scene, food and wine scene is amazing, obviously, but you soon realize that you start to work with a lot of the same references. It's a really small world, like in any city. I mean, you know everyone really fast. The wines are, it's a little village. And the wines were really recurrent at one point. And I figured if I want to improve as a person and as a sommelier, obviously, that would be interesting for me to just taste something else, something that I actually taste in the location and not trying to get Portuguese wines in France, which is really complicated, by the way. So I had two options, really. I was thinking about Italy and Portugal. What made me come to Lisbon was obviously no one knows about Portuguese wines. Some people see some beautiful bottles of yours coming up the ranks every year, just figure out, okay, that Portugal like starts to become a little scene. So, all right, Lisbon it was.
That's interesting. And why specifically, you know, why Portuguese wines? Do you think we have a special sort of character or?
Well, and really about this curiosity to say, we have Portugal is complicated, from the outside, for the food culture, the wine culture, you always consider, I mean, that's what I felt in being French in France, you always consider that it's a derivation of a Spanish culture, when it's really not. And so that was something that I wanted to prove and to learn by myself. There were this kind of fights, Portugal has something to say, so better listen to it.
Yeah, and now you're at Prazo, which is a very exciting project here in Portugal. I'm happy to say that I'm a recurring customer, and I really recommend everyone to go to Prazo because Antonio Galapito and this team are doing incredible stuff with farm-to-table dining here in Portugal, which we actually, I don't think we've had that sort of experience in Lisbon and in restaurants before in Portugal. But the wine list is also something very, very interesting, and it's something that you obviously take a lot of pride in. What are sort of the main principles behind the Prazo's wine list?
Well, so I actually came after Maria. She was the sommelier when Prado opened. She was Spanish herself. So I arrived with an already settled wine list. It was a little bit shorter, but the wine was following the food. The more local, the more respectable, environmentally friendly wine, and also trying to play on the discovery in general, the surprise also, and always this feeling to be a little bit different, to make people curious, because Antonio's food is really about this also, like something, a simple dish, a simple product, the most delicious it can be, cooked the simple way and with always a little surprise. And I figured the wine has to bring this sparkle also. To open something that you can read green wine, that you can read Alentejo, but that is actually not that what it's supposed to be. You see the label, but the liquid is different. So that was the point.
You guys have a lot of wines that that sort of surprise you in that way. I remember that one of the bottles I've had was from Bairrada, and it was by Filipa Pato.
Yeah.
And it's a Baga.
Yeah.
It's a varietal, which is, you know, it's very, and if you've listened to the last episodes of the podcast, you, the listener, will know exactly what I'm talking about. We're talking about a very
Baga.
Acidic wine and a very tannic wine, and it's nothing of the sort. It's a very elegant wine, a very fresh wine, and it's interesting that everything you have
Filipa,
there.
Filipa makes wine that are really delicate in that way. She's taking this grape that is can be really rustic in the first way we consume Baga, and there is this new generation of Bairrada making really delicate light maceration Baga, which are like amazing. This is probably one of my favorite grapes since I arrived.
I have no qualms in saying it is my favorite Portuguese grape. And it's very interesting what is happening nowadays. And but Prado also prides itself on having a natural and biodynamic wine. And what are these two terms? What does this mean?
Well, big question. That can be like the subject of one full episode. But basically, we got three big families of wine. You'll start with the bio wine, which actually concerns the way you raise the grape with the bio certification label. That's it. That will give you the little green leaf on the label, bio wine. You'll then have the biodynamic philosophy of wine that concerns the way that the grape is raised and the way the wine is embottled. So you get two stages. You will have to work with bio grape, and then you will have a minimum entrant product that you can add to your wine. It's a matter of a lot of chemicals. It's also a matter of sulfur, and that's something like a lot of people make reference to. And then we'll have finally what we call natural, which is the least interventionist possibility to make wine, what we also call pur jus in France, which is for us, and like the, because it's really true, the pure expression of the grape, the terroir, and the person who made it, because you have no you bring no change whatsoever to the juice that you produced. So yeah, the three families.
So you have no, you know, no, nothing being added when you're doing the maceration. Nothing being added.
They will always. It really depends. And from a year to another, a winemaker can literally decide to change the way he embottled his wine. It's really a matter of philosophy behind the way you make the wine. It's not a matter of how much sulfur the bottle contains. It's like, what did the winemaker wanted to make with that wine? Of course, when you have a cuvée that is especially like hard and unstable, well, some people will put a little bit of sulfite. Yeah, it does happen, but it doesn't mean that the wine is no good or no natural anymore.
And is that a sort of movement that has come a lot in Portuguese wines? Is that something common?
It's still a really slow and really small community. Sorry, the community is not slow. It's a slow movement, right? The community is great. few winemakers. Well, it's growing every day, which is nice to be at Prado, that we're aware really fast of who is going to be the next producer to actually transfer to biodynamy or natural. Like this little French girl living now in Trás-os-Montes by herself, like... Yeah, Menina, Aline, you'll have to taste her wine. That's amazing. But well, every month, like you can hear about a new winemaker, a Portuguese one doing this kind of process, which is great. And the persons who are already on the market, Filipa Pato, Tiago Teles, Victor Claro, sorry. Well, they are doing fabulous wines and... Filipa Pato, for example, she's doing like wines that are actually like really, really good sellers. Like people know her. They don't drink Filipa Pato for it to be bio, but she's doing a really nice job.
Because she is
because she's
producer.
Actually a good winemaker. Yeah, and they all are.
And now talking a little bit about your a little bit more about your métier, so to say, what is the daily life of a sommelier? What is it exactly? You know, when we think about a sommelier, what do you do?
Well, so as you said, sommelier makes actually the wine list of a restaurant and serve the wine. So I'm both in the cellar and in service. But well, what does it imply to make the wine list? Is like you will have to find the wines. That is the most probably the most important job that we have to do. Where is the wine? How is it made? By who? That is the research point of the job. And for me, probably the most important, because that's really the bringing the value that you bring to the client more than the wine afterwards during the service. Is basically this story. How did the wine arrive on this table in front of you, and how come it's going to work with the food for a lot of reasons, for a lot of stories. So that's this part. And well, then you got obviously the training in service for all of the staff. So that's the point that I really enjoy a lot. At Prado, we have now that this wine shop that opened also, Merceria, is, people working for us, if they want to work with wine, it's nice for them like also to have this kind of education around what they sell. So that's a big part. And then you got the service, the rush.
What is it like? Like what do you consider when you're, you know, pairing a wine with food or, you know, trying to... when a customer wants a...
It's always complicated because basically when you arrive on the table, you have really different kind of clients. Either someone who exactly knows where he wants to go, either someone who is actually going to leave you the freedom to go with the flow. For the first kind, you will obviously try to always find, again, like this little surprise, like to follow his wants, but... with a little change. And well, on the other, because I really love Antonio's food and I know it now after a year, like pretty well, I'm having a lot of fun pairing with this food.
Yeah, because it's interesting because you guys, you know, the food at Prado is very light. It's a lot of times it's about those sort of unexpected flavors that you were talking about. It's, you know, it's a very, I remember a dish that I had here, which was just this fish cavalla, just slightly braised with tangerine. And that sort of combination is very appealing and very interesting. And then when you're choosing a wine to go with that, you also don't want something that will mask the flavors of the produce.
So Prado is basically working with a small plates, tapas version actually of dishes. It gives me then a lot of freedom also for the pairing and for the wine list, because people are really going into complete different directions during the meal. They're gonna have fish, meat, veg, strong, smooth, ice, hot, warm, cold. They will have like really a lot of things that are happening. With the wines, basically, I allow myself to go for something like on an extremely light red, extremely deep whites. We introduced also on the wine list the orange section, obviously, which are amazing wines, gastronomic wines. The acidity of the white, texture of a red, you can't imagine how beautiful it is. Orange section, for example, is something like I really care about because people are actually really curious about that term and always really curious to taste.
That's cool. And when you're, you know, when you're looking for new bottles, or how is it exactly the process? Do you find the bottles? Do the bottles sort of find you? How does it work?
It depends. Again, Prado now, I mean, we have the capacity to we have a really good communication about the restaurant. So people actually come to us sometimes. Some winemakers knock the door. Then that's a matter of distribution also, well, because we have few distributors still in Portugal for natural wines. Of course, we have Os Goriardos, which are the headline of this team, which they're doing an amazing job in importing international, but also representing Portuguese natural in Lisbon. So distributors, obviously, and then curiosity and scratching on social media, scratching on people that you know, from winemaker to winemaker, to, you know, who is doing what, when is it getting in bottles, when can I taste, where is it, give it to me.
I've seen that the sort of natural wine community that is burgeoning up in Portugal. You guys are a very sort of close-knit network, you know. You have some places which are selling, some places which are restaurants, some places which are wine bars. And so I'm assuming you also, you know, sommeliers talk to sommeliers.
Exactly. And again, like this natural wine community, I don't know if you can call it that way, but is still pretty small in Lisbon. I'm thinking about Jennifer again, Alejandro. So Jennifer Rebel, who is a great American lady who actually started to import natural wines in Portugal. So she's importing Austria, Spain, Italy, and France now. Alejandro Chavarro, who is one of the best sommeliers in France, who actually came here to Lisbon also to import some amazing wines, doing incredible masterclass. Rita from Comida Independent, who has like this beautiful wine shop, really promoting, having events with the winemakers, always tasting. We all rotate in the same circle, and we give force, I think, also to each other. We always come up with new ideas because of this, so super grateful.
And just to wrap up this interview part of our episode, I would just like to take the time to ask you, you know, if someone is thinking of becoming a sommelier, what would you recommend to them? What is the proper course of action?
Well, since I didn't follow the proper path, obviously. Being a sommelier, I think, like, it's, I mean, I will encourage you to go to school, obviously. I wish I could have go maybe to school before, but the thing is, like, to be curious, to understand every single time you drink something, what is this? Why is it good? Why I like it? What I don't like it? And then to work really about this empathy that you'll have with the empathy that you'll like with the client. For me, that's the most important thing we can do. Like, what will make you happy at that point, on that table, at that time, with that person in front of you? Look at the eyes of the client and figure, like, it's gonna work out.
Yeah. And so now the sort of, I'm going to switch to Portuguese again, just to give this short introduction. A próxima parte do episódio é novamente uma espécie de prova, ou seja, um bocadinho mais aquilo que nós temos vindo a fazer. O Zenith Bar Galeria foi extremamente simpático e conseguiu arranjar-nos umas garrafas de um vinho muito interessante, que é o de um produtor muito interessante, que são os vinhos Beira, BEYRA, que são os vinhos da região da Beira Interior. São vinhos de altitude, ou seja, vinhos são produzidos a 700 metros, se eu não me engano. E num outro episódio nós podemos tentar ver mais teoricamente o que é que isto significa, mas basicamente agora o que nós vamos tentar fazer é provar estes vinhos Beira. Temos um branco, temos um rosé e temos um tinto, e vamos convidar o público que está aqui connosco também a provar o vinho e a tentar ser um bocadinho guiado nesta história das provas guiadas. E eu vou pedir sobretudo à Camille que tente guiar-nos um bocadinho por isto que é a prova. Nós já fizemos várias provas aqui nestes episódios do sumo de uva, mas tentar também ter a visão de uma profissional, por assim dizer, sobre as provas. O primeiro vinho que vamos provar é o Beira Branco, da região da Beira Interior, 2018. É 50% Síria, 50% Fontecal. E agora vamos ouvir a opinião de perito da Cabi, por assim dizer. So, Cami, when you're tasting wine, what do you start by doing?
Well, three steps: looking, smelling, tasting. Well, white wine here, Berra Interior. So, as you said, you'll have a wine that grows in altitude. You'll have a clear, juicy, usually white. Well, so for you to look at a wine, white surface, as clear as possible, obviously. What's important, like when you see a wine, what can give you hints about what it is? The color, obviously, the depth of the color. Then you get, of course, the alcohol content of the wine by the couleur on the glass. You'll have the nose, obviously. So here, straight on fruit, a little bit of vegetality also, lemony notes, and then you get the taste.
It seems like a very common Syria, so to say. So that's
Syria will always bring the fruit. Syria is either grows in the lens, a little bit in the Alentejo, a super aromatic grape, always very confident, so bringing really, really aromatic wines. I work with the beautiful Syria also at Prado. I really enjoy that grape. Something about the tasting in general at Prado, because always people consider that you only have one truth about wine, which is actually not right. Every person can relate to a wine in a different way. You will have a wine definition, the grape, the terroir, but you have interpretation always, and you will have millions of possible interpretation for wines, even like in between, sommelier, when we go for tasting, some of us can smell complete different things, but because we experienced different smells, we experienced different wines before, so never be ashamed of what you think of a wine. When you look at someone in the eye, it's like, is that apple? Like, yeah, if you smell apple, that's apple to you. It's fine.
That's something I'm going to encourage our audience to do
exactly
right now, which is to just take in the wine, just smell it, and, you know, just think a little bit of what you smell in there. If you think you smell fruit, if you think you smell citrus.
Everyone would be right anyway.
I smell what I think is some minerality, but that's one of the...
Minerality can be also a subject of a full episode.
Yeah, exactly. It's a
very confusing... What is minerality in wine?
Yeah, I always say I smell like salty in the wine.
Yodic, minerality is linked to different things. The freshness of the wine, the acidity, the yod, and the earthiness, the shoki notes. So it's always very complicated. You'll have really shoky wines, but with no acidity, or they're considered mineral, it's always complicated.
And what do you think on the mouth? Is it an acidic wine?
You got something with acidity, which is actually weird. Because you were saying it was a wine that grows in altitude, here you actually have acidity, but not too much. You can, when you compare to the neighbor region of Daum, for example, that you'll find 600, 700 meter altitude wines, you'll find strong acidity. This one is actually pretty smooth.
It's a very, I would say it's a very, on the mouth, it is very, I don't think it is, that this is, it, this is maybe not an apt descriptor, but it's a very controlled wine when it comes to, you know, even the tannins, even, it's fresh,
that's an
it's
easy
fruity.
Wine. Yeah. You get a little bit of everything.
Yeah. It's an interesting wine. Let's maybe move on to we also have a rosé from the same producer. Agora vamos passar ao rosé. What do you think about this one?
So, rosé. Big thing about rosé, selling rosé in Portugal, because a lot of people have this reference of the Côte de Provence always, and always judging the rosé by the color. That's probably one of the most painful thing I have to do at the restaurant. Is to sell rosé. I want the clearest, I want a Portuguese Côte de Provence. That's the point of wine. Côte de Provence is in France. Portugal is going to make a different kind of rosé. If you're looking for something dry with acidity, it's fine. We're going to find for something. But rosé is a really tough category of wine to work with because people want a really particular kind of rosé all the time. So this one in particular, that's why like you can prove that you can have something actually really crisp with high acidity, completely fresh. That's why it is here. A little bit more of alcohol, but you get something really, really fresh.
Basicamente, este rosé, e já agora não sei se tiveram a oportunidade de provar o rosé, olhando também a um rosé que lá está, na cor não é propriamente aquilo que nós consideraríamos normalmente um rosé, vai um bocadinho para lá do dito do Mateus, que é um bocadinho a referência que os portugueses têm, penso, quando pensam sobre rosé. É um vinho extremamente claro, com uma palidez muito interessante, é tinta roriz, no nariz muito floral, muito, muito fresco, um vinho muito interessante, extremamente acídico, ou com uma boa acidez, aliás, não é extrema, mas com uma boa acidez, muito fresco, muito...
A completely different acidity than the white.
Yeah.
That you can see, that's probably growing higher... Higher
altitude, that's interesting. That's an interesting point of view to consider. Como a acidez, se repararem, se compararem a acidez deste vinho com o vinho branco, é uma acidez muito diferente, é uma acidez mais cortante, mais é muito interessante, e o final também é um bocadinho mais longo. Este rosé, para mim, é um rosé um bocadinho aromático, um bocadinho gastronómico. É um rosé que pediria... alguns queijos que eu me conseguia ver a juntar,
but that's
talvez.
The part of the fight basically, because rosé is now considered a aperitif wine, when really the same as orange, you'll have all the textures that you can have for the highest gastronomic wines. So it's like reintroducing people to drink rosé while eating is a something it's complicated.
But this is something that I could perfectly pair up
completely
with a meal.
Yeah.
E agora, se calhar, passávamos ao Tinto. Agora temos o Tinto, o Beira Tinto. Também, neste caso, 2017, que é 75% tinta roriz e 25% Touriga Nacional. Também um vinho de altitude, neste caso a 700 metros. What do you think?
So that is for me like a really old school typical Portuguese red that you can find. Touriga Nacional, it's pretty incredible. Like you have this amazing grape in Portugal, like always this deep coconut notes that you'll find. As soon as you'll find Touriga Nacional, you feel like coconut anyway. It's crazy.
I never thought of that descriptor, but if it's
usually violet or coconut.
I usually go
but
with
then
violet.
Violet is like because here also the tinta roriz will be really on the red, dark red fruits actually. Well, you get rustic in the way that you'll have texture, you'll have tannins, you'll have fruit, you'll have a little bit of acidity, but you have pretty strong tannins at the end. You have something that has shape.
That's a nice way to put it. Já agora, quando olhamos para este vinho, obviamente é um vinho tinto, portanto logo a cor vai ser bastante diferente, mas vemos uma cor forte, um vinho que mesmo assim não é muito, ou seja, não tem propriamente muito peso quando olhamos para ele, portanto diremos um vinho jovem ou um vinho que não envelheceu muito na garrafa. No nariz, a violeta, nomeadamente da Touriga Nacional. Nós, no podcast, já teremos provado, a esta altura já provámos vários Tourigas Nacionais e, portanto, sabemos ver esses tons de violeta, mas de coco também, como a Camille estava a dizer, que é um descritivo muito interessante que eu nunca tinha considerado. Na boca, um vinho tânico. Ou seja, um vinho old school também, como a Camille disse, quando pensamos em vinhos portugueses, em tintos portugueses, um vinho tânico, um vinho com alguma acidez, um vinho muito interessante, que pede comida, também acho que eu não beberia isto sozinho, mas com alguma, há várias comidas com que eu me viria.
Quer dizer, agora que penso nisso, não,
know,
se calhar,
never know.
Realmente, se calhar
sometimes you just, you know.
Yeah, sometimes you just need a little you. Red wine, yeah, to get it, to make it through the day. Não, mas é um vinho, também é um vinho muito interessante, também um vinho de altitude, portanto, novamente, alguma acidez, talvez um bocadinho mais de acidez do que aquilo que seria de esperar num vinho produzido ao nível do mar, por assim dizer. Mas um vinho muito interessante também. É um vinho que, sendo algo rústico, ou seja, sendo um vinho tradicional português, tem um final extremamente elegante, onde se nota particularmente bem esse undertone de coco, diria eu.
It's crazy, huh? Yeah, every single time you have to again.
It's really good.
É assim um bocadinho que se provam vinhos. Também vimos aqui a opinião de uma profissional de uma forma um bocadinho diferente daquilo que temos visto nos outros episódios, ou seja, um bocadinho menos teórica, um bocadinho mais prática, por assim dizer, e um bocadinho mais tendo em conta as diferenças entre vinhos e até as diferenças entre países. E aí, lá está, que a mim tem uma experiência, uma bagagem que eu não tenho nesse aspecto. Eu estou muito limitado a vinhos portugueses, a mim pode compará-los com vinhos franceses e etc, que é uma coisa que eu gostaria de um dia ser capaz de fazer.
I bring you some bottles.
Oh, yes. Desde já agradecer novamente ao Beira, aos produtores de vinho Beira, por nos terem disponibilizado estas garrafas, aos Zenith Bar Galeria também por nos ter providenciado este espaço, a todas as pessoas que aqui estão a ver e que nos acompanharam um bocadinho nesta prova, também pela amabilidade que tiveram em estar aqui presentes a esta hora já um bocadinho tardia, e a vocês ouvintes por estarem para este episódio mais especial, e eu reservo-vos a minha voz mais grave e mais radiofónica, e agradecer como sempre à Bruá Produções por nos dar esta oportunidade magnífica de estarmos aqui a falar um bocadinho mais sobre esta coisa que é o sumo de uva fermentado com todas as suas dimensões mágicas, e no próximo episódio vamos falar finalmente de vinhos da Bairrada. Posso desde já dar essa nota, que vamos tentar ver expressões um bocadinho diferentes da baga. Basicamente vamos tentar aquilo que eu espero que arranjem, é um monocasta baga, um branco baga bical e um espumante branco da Bairrada, um blanc de blanc, como se costuma dizer, e vamos tentar ver um bocadinho essa variedade de vinhos dessa região magnífica que é a Bairrada. Mas como sempre, se tiverem alguma dúvida, comentário, sugestão, etc, por favor deixem-nos um comentário no Facebook, mandem-nos um e-mail, cheguem-nos pelas redes sociais, feedback é sempre bem-vindo. Vamos tentar fazer também mais destes episódios especiais, com entrevistas, com mais visões um bocadinho mais práticas sobre o que é isto do vinho, e portanto, até lá, que bebam muito sumo de uva fermentado. Obrigado.